Like a dragonfly whisking over a pond, the Bell helicopter flew in low from the east. In defiance of the law, its running lights were off. Invisible in the darkness, it skimmed the treetops on a course that would soon bring it to the top of the next mountain. Inside, four figures clad in skin-tight black suits were as still as statues. The Spider Mountain Research Facility hove into sight. Spotlights continued to illuminate the site, including the crowd at the main gate. The buildings, though, were still dark.
This is it, boys. Remember the drill we worked out? It'll be as easy as pie.
You hope. In a few seconds, the copter was clear of the trees, and he dipped almost to ground level, angling the Bell toward the makeshift airfield. He was relying on the aircraft already parked there to conceal their approach. Romero crossed himself and picked up the gas mask in his lap.
Good. Everything is just as we want it.
Madonna preserve us. Here goes nothing.
I'm locked and loaded and primed for bear. I just hope Luther Harkin appreciates all the trouble we're going to on his account.
No, sir!
Drastically reducing speed, Tanner brought the Bell down mere yards from the tail of a news chopper. He immediately killed the power and was out the door before the rotor stopped spinning. Bending low, he ran in a zigzag pattern toward the front gate. The other members of Executive Protection Incorporated mimicked him. They were halfway there when Tanner caught a whiff of smoke and spotted a man near another copter smoking a cigarette. He stopped on a dime and raised his right forearm, his fist clenched. The others took that as their cue to flatten. The smoker wore a cap and jacket typical of a pilot. He was idly watching the goings-on at the gate, the cap pushed back on his head. Tanner crept to the left. Hugging his knapsack close to his chest, he wound past several more choppers. A row of bushes provided convenient cover less than 20 feet from the crowd. Hunkering, he noted the positions of the nearest National Guardsman on perimeter duty along the fence. It was approaching the top of the hour, and several news crews were about to go live with updates.
Hold the mirror up a little higher, Jesse. I can't see. Live from Spider Mountain, in a scene reminiscent of... In a scene eerily like...
Cameramen fussed with their equipment and checked their lighting. Tanner nodded at his companions, then donned his gas mask. Opening the knapsack, he took out five cylindrical canisters made of rolled steel. On each was imprinted M7A3 Riot CS. He handed one to each of his teammates and kept the rest for himself. There was a minor commotion at the gate. A man and a woman had stepped out. The reporters flocked to them like vultures to carrion, a score or more asking questions all at once.
Have you heard any reports from the inside?
What's being done to help those people trapped below?
Do you know exactly who's down there?
Ladies and gentlemen, I have no new information to impart at this time, other than the work crews expect to have the power restored any time now.
Mr. Pratt, any word on when you will send a team down?
By dawn at the latest. You there, you have a question?
Have you heard from the people trapped below? They must be going crazy after all this time.
It can't be helped. Our priority is containment and decon. Slow and easy is the order of the day. If we go rushing in half-cocked, we might unleash a biological genie from a bottle. And once out, we might never be able to put it back.
Has there been any pressure put on you by Harkin Industries to find Luther Harkin?
Tanner motioned at Sax and Romero, tapped his watch, then held up three fingers. They nodded, looked at their watches, and crept off through the bushes toward the fence. Bert Anderson was fingering his canister with an air of regret.
I wish you would reconsider.
We're past that point. Be ready on my cue.
The reporters switched their attention to the young woman beside Pratt. She began detailing the damage done to the electrical and communication systems.
Every surge protector and fuse was blown out, and half the wiring was fried to a crisp. It's a reminder that for all our fail-safes, all our planning and modern technology, no system is ever foolproof.
1 minute.
Accidents happen. Mother Nature throws tantrums all the time. Hurricanes, hailstorms, tornadoes, thunderstorms. We're no closer to controlling nature than we were in the Stone Age.
30 seconds.
Tanner held the riot control grenade in his right hand, his thumb firmly over the arming sleeve. He removed the safety pin and gave the nod. Then, taking several swift steps to the edge of the bushes, he rolled the canister toward the crowd. They were all looking toward the pair at the gate, and they were making so much noise no one noticed. Anderson did likewise. Over by the fence, Sax and Romero were rolling their canisters toward the National Guardsmen. As soon as the grenades were released, their delay elements began to burn. Within split seconds of one another, the detonators burst, rupturing the canisters and spewing the CS filler into the air. Rapidly spreading clouds formed, each over 5 yards in circumference. Those in the thick of the chemical clouds staggered or fell to their knees, while those not yet affected shoved one another to escape the writhing tendrils of gas. Panic spread like a prairie fire.
It's the biotoxin!
People raced from the south to help, but the spreading clouds brought them to a halt. Romero and Sax rejoined Tanner and Anderson. In a compact phalanx, they dashed into the nearest cloud, their gas masks enabling them to breathe where no one else could. Reporters littered the ground like so many leaves. Tanner vaulted a woman thrashing madly about. He avoided a man who grabbed at his leg. The clouds were overlapping. It was child's play for them to reach the open gate unnoticed. Once they were through, Tanner tossed his second canister. As the CS spurted, he led the way at a sprint to the main building. No one challenged them. No one tried to stop them. Confusion ran rampant. The doors wouldn't open. Undaunted, Tanner jogged around the corner. A side door was also secure, but not for long. Stepping back, he triggered a dozen rounds into the lock. They needed the aid of pencil flashlights to navigate the lobby. At the elevators, Tanner fished in his knapsack and produced a titanium crowbar, which he applied to one of the doors. Sax lent a hand, and they pried the door wide enough for the four of them to slip inside. Tanner squatted and looped his hands together.
Up you go. Ugh.
Tanner boosted Romero to the emergency access panel in the ceiling of the elevator car. Romero opened it and hauled himself up. Lowering an arm, he helped each of them in turn onto the roof. Stepping to the edge, Anderson peered down into the inky depths of the shaft. Tanner was removing military rappelling gear from his knapsack, including a rope, a harness, carabiners, and descenders.
It's still not too late to change our minds.
Enough already. Get with the program. Everything will work out fine. Wait and see.
The executioner was never prone to a condition known in common parlance as the heebie-jeebies. First and foremost, in training and temperament, he was a soldier. His mind, like his body, had been honed to a razor's edge. He placed a high premium on clear, crisp, logical thinking. Things that went bump in the night never fazed him, because he knew there was always a rational explanation. Even so, even knowing the Berserkers were the result of bioengineering gone haywire, Boland couldn't stop his skin from crawling as he stared at the dozens of slavering, red-eyed horrors in the corridor. Their fingers made obscene squeaking sounds on the glass.
Bloody hell! Keep them out! Don't let those lunatics near me!
A renewed onslaught on the door spurred Bolin into turning to the leader of Phoenix Force. Bolin tossed McCarter his flashlight.
Catch. Get Chandler to the back of the room. I'll hold off the crazies as best I can.
Unzipping his biohazard suit, he ejected the Beretta's partially spent magazine and slid it into an inner pocket, then slapped home a fresh one. He folded down the grip in front of the trigger guard, checked that the fire selector was set on the one lone white dot per single shot, and braced for the attack. It came a heartbeat later. Seven of the intruders died, but the rest never slowed. They converged in a living wall, blocking off any hope of escape. The executioner wouldn't flee if he could, not when there were Carolyn Edmonds and Bryce Chandler to think of. The two-legged beasts creating the uproar would stop at nothing until they had ripped their prey limb from limb. Bolin wasn't about to let them. He had barely made a dent in the Berserkers. Backpedaling, Bolin ejected the magazine and replaced it with the last of his full ones. Again, the Berserkers rushed him. Suddenly, McCarter was at Bolin's elbow, the Glock in one hand, the two flashlights in the other. He shone the twin beams at their red-eyed faces and took swift aim. But a strange thing happened. Many of the berserkers in the front ranks recoiled, blinking furiously. Some averted their heads entirely.
I'll be damned!
McCarter dashed closer, practically shoving the flashlights in their faces. Bolin understood now why the crazies had held off attacking in the stairwell. They couldn't stand bright light. The drug seemed to have rendered their eyes extremely sensitive. It wasn't much of an advantage, but the wily Briton was exploiting it fully, and the berserkers were hastily retreating. The soldier saw one attacker try to get at McCarter from the side. Another squatted and grabbed at McCarter's ankles. Bolin whirled. Bryce Chandler was locked in combat with a berserker who had one hand clamped onto Edmund's blouse. Somehow, the man brute had made it past Bolin and McCarter. Bolin fixed a hasty bead on the back of the attacker's head, but just then, Chandler hauled on his foe's arm and tore the offending hand off Edmund's. Chandler and the berserker spun completely around. The soldier glanced at McCarter. He was driving the last few crazed lab workers out into the corridor. Bolin returned his attention to Chandler.
No!
The madman had slammed Chandler against the file cabinet and was slowly but inexorably lowering his teeth toward the man's exposed throat. Luther Harkin didn't even try to help. Pivoting to cover McCarter, he was just in time to plant a slug in the temple of a drooling woman who was slinking toward the Briton unnoticed. He downed another in the act of scrabbling out the window. The remainder melted into the shadows. McCarter halted shy of the doorway. Mustering a grin, he wagged the flashlights.
Let there be light.
Bolin hastened to Bryce Chandler, who had collapsed on the floor and was writhing in agony. Edmunds knelt and tried to grip Chandler's hand, but he pulled loose and rolled onto his side, his teeth clenched. There were no new external wounds that Bolin could see.
Where does it hurt?
Inside. I think a few ribs are cracked.
Hang on. We'll see about binding you up.
Bolin surveyed the bodies for signs of life. Only when he was satisfied they were indeed dead did he sit on the desk and eject the Beretta's magazine. It was half empty. Sliding the other clips from his pocket, he thumbed out the unused cartridges. There were enough left to almost fill one mag. McCarter was splashing a flashlight beam up and down the hallway.
I don't see the buggers. They must have gone off to lick their wounds. I believe this is yours.
McCarter extended one of the flashlights to Bolin. Bolin trained it on Chandler, who now had the knuckles of both hands pressed to his mouth. Scanning the room, Bolin realized a lab coat on a rack in the corner was just the item they needed. Retrieving it, he remembered a pair of scissors he had seen in the top drawer of the desk. In short order, he had cut four wide strips of cloth, long enough to wrap around Chandler's torso. Edmunds insisted on doing the honors. She eased off Chandler's jacket, wadded it up, and slipped it under his head for a pillow. Luther Harkin swaggered over as she was applying the first strip.
Now will you listen to me when I tell you that the only smart option we have is to make it to the surface? We can't hold off another attack, and you know it. I'm talking to you, dammit.
Leave him alone.
Or what? Exactly what in hell do you think you're going to do?
Just this?
Sax was peering into a fully stocked laboratory. The beam of his flashlight illuminated work tables and an electron microscope. It revealed racks of test tubes, vials, and beakers, along with other sophisticated equipment, the purpose of which they couldn't begin to guess. But there was one thing it didn't reveal.
There's no one in here either.
Where is everybody? We've searched almost the entire floor and haven't found a soul.
I don't like this. I don't like this one bit.
All right. I admit this isn't what I expected. But that doesn't mean we're giving up. Our client is down here somewhere, and we're not leaving without him. We'll check the final two rooms, then head down to the next level. Move it, people. You know the drill.
Anderson brought up the rear, watching their backs. Nothing moved behind them. The place was as dead as a morgue. Yet the newscasts claimed well over 100 workers had been trapped underground.
Madre de Dios. What in the name of God was that?
Whatever it is, I don't want any part of it.
This rescue mission of ours is turning weird, boys and girls. I'm beginning to think you were right all this time, Bert. We're in over our heads. Maybe we should bail while the bailing is good.
Listen to the three of you. Since when does EPI leave a job half finished? We've come this far, we'll see it through to the end.
Didn't you just hear that thing?
Sure, I heard it. There's a dog down here, so what?
That didn't sound like no dog to me. I'll stick this out if you want, but I think we're making a mistake.
Unbelievable. I never thought I'd live to see the day when all of you would turn into a bunch of candy asses.
Tanner came to a door and angrily flung it open.
Keep this up and you're liable.
Liable to what?
When there was no reply, Anderson and the others moved forward. Shock hit them like a slap in the face. The room was a conference room. An oval mahogany table took up most of the space. Bodies lay strewed across it, under it, beside it. 20 or more men and women, young and old. Most had been mutilated to the point where their next of kin would never recognize them. Blood was everywhere, in puddles on the table, in pools on the carpet, splattered thick on the walls, spots on the ceiling. Anderson's gut did flip-flops.
What could have done this?
Whatever it was must still be down here, and it might decide to come after us next.
We shall get out of here. This is more than a rescue mission now.
No, that's exactly what it is. No biotoxin did this. Something flesh and blood was to blame. Something we can kill.
You're not serious.
Never more so. Harkin will be doubly grateful when we bail his fat out of the fire. He'll praise us to high heaven to anyone who will listen.
You hope.
Think of it, boys. We'll be heroes. We'll be on every talk show in the country. New clients will be beating down the door to sign up. It'll be all we've ever hoped for.
Provided the government doesn't throw us behind bars for 10 years for this little stunt.
Harkin will use his influence to keep the feds off our backs. He wields a lot of clout in high places.
Let's consider a few things. First, we have no guarantee Harkin will stick up for us. If the feds decide to nail us to the wall, he might back off to avoid bad publicity.
Good point.
Second, and more importantly, we have no idea what we're getting ourselves into. Whatever slaughtered these people might be more than we can handle.
You never give up, do you? You've been against this from the start, and you're using every excuse that comes along to shoot holes in it.
I just don't want something to eat holes in us. Damn it, Tanner, you're not thinking straight. You see this as our jump to the big leagues, when all it might be is a jump into our graves.
Fellas.
Do you know what your problem is? You've become soft. You're not the kick-butt soldier you once were. You've forgotten how to take danger in stride.
Fellas. You're right. I'm not the same man I was when we met. I'm older. I'm wiser. And I know when I'm in over my head.
Romero stepped between them and pointed down the corridor. A vague figure had appeared out of the murk. All four of them swung their flashlights toward it, but it was too far off to make out much detail other than it stood on two legs.
I want to know what that is.
A person. What else?
You there. We mean you no harm. We're with Executive Protection Incorporated.
Tanner took several steps forward. Whoever it was shuffled a few feet closer, then stopped.
We're looking for Luther Harkin. Can you tell us where to find him?
Is it me? Or are that sucker's eyes red?
You're imagining things.
My name is Ike Tanner. These are my business associates. Identify yourself, please.
I think he's a woman.
Didn't you hear me? You have no cause to be afraid. We won't harm you.
What the hell is wrong with her?
If I didn't know better, I'd swear she was going to attack us.
The next moment, that was exactly what the woman did. The broken door made an excellent stretcher. Bolin and McCarter exercised great care as they slid Bryce Chandler onto it. McCarter took one end, Luther Harkin took the other, and they started down the corridor in search of a safe haven. Harkin hadn't said a word since the Briton had punched him. Like a petulant child, he had sulked until Bolin ordered him to help. Even then, he glared in blatant spite and wasn't particularly careful about jostling Chandler. Edmonds had hold of the NSA man's hand.
Hang in there. As soon as the lockdown is lifted, we'll rush you to a hospital.
Chandler smiled, but his heart wasn't in it. He was terribly pale and sweat covered him like a second skin. Bolin had talked it over with McCarter and had reached a reluctant decision. One of them had to stay behind. Edmonds and Chandler stood little hope of surviving on their own, not with killers hovering in the shadows, waiting for another opportunity to strike. Boland could hear some moving about in the dark at that very moment. A closed door yielded to a twist of the knob. It was another office, larger than the last, with a long row of file cabinets along the right wall. The cabinets gave Boland an idea. Pushing the door as wide as it would go, he motioned for McCarter and Harkin to carry Chandler inside. Edmonds paused, anxiety shrouding her like a mantle of doom. McCarter steered the stretcher to a bare spot and gently lowered his end down. Harkin wasn't nearly as considerate and let go when the door was still a couple of inches off the floor. It hit with a thump.
If I make it out of this alive, Luther, I'll be paying you a visit as soon as I recover.
I'm trembling in my socks.
Those things won't hold off forever, will they?
The lights are bound to come back on eventually. They'll be easy to subdue then.
Harkin walked over to a chair to do more sulking. Boland beckoned to McCarter. He held out the Beretta. The Phoenix Force leader made no move to accept the pistol.
If you lose this, you owe me a new one.
I take it you've decided to go after Hal yourself? Why you and not me?
I've known him longer.
Granted. But what will you use to fight off the Beastie Brigade? Spitballs? Keep it. I'll make do.
You have people to protect. I don't. You'll need it more than I will. Remember to go for the head.
All right. I'll take the Beretta, but I'm doing this under protest. And only on one condition. We swap. There are 8 rounds left.
Thanks. I recommend stacking file cabinets against the door and window.
My thinking exactly. It's been a pleasure, Mac. I mean that sincerely.
You make it sound like we'll never see each other again.
Boland shook his comrade's hand, then spun and broke into a run. He flashed his light over every doorway and window he approached to foil a potential ambush. The stairwell was eerily still. Boland descended rapidly but noiselessly, his flashlight cutting a brilliant swath out of the gloom. He passed the landing to sublevel 9 without incident, then sublevel 10. Midway to 11, he stopped. Shoes had scuffed on a step below. Leaning over the rail, he splayed the beam downward. What he saw was enough to spawn nightmares for eternity. A knot of figures was hunched over a body at the bottom. The moment the light struck them, they raised their arms over their eyes and scurried under the stairs, except for one. Boland resumed his descent, only to stop in his tracks as a chilling realization knifed through him. The body at the bottom of the stairs was about the same height and weight as Brognola.
No, not like that.
Boland went down the stairs on the fly. 3 crazies moved to meet him. He saw the victim's face and halted, flooded by relief. Enough remained to show it wasn't his friend. Like a stalking panther, Boland sidled to sublevel 12. Growls and hisses warned him that there were berserkers under the stairs. The berserkers would be after him as soon as the dark enveloped them again. With only 4 rounds left, it would be folly to confront them. Boland pushed through the doorway. He was tempted to shout Brognola's name, but it would only alert other crazies to his presence. Going from doorway to doorway, he sought some sign of his friend. The soldier was not one to bear his feelings in public, but the truth was, he had stuck with the feds as long as he had, in large part because of his respect and admiration for Brognola. By nature, Boland was a loner. Even during his military days, as a sniper, he had spent weeks on his own in the field. Later, when he launched his war everlasting, he had waged it alone for the longest time. He did everything his own way, and he had been supremely effective. So much so, the government approached him with their offer. They would stop hunting him, would stop trying to put him behind bars if he agreed to work with them and wage the war on their terms. Boland had agreed, but not because he trusted them. He joined the Stony Man program because it gave him access to intel and hardware he could never access on his own. Still, he'd had to make a major attitude adjustment. Hal Brognola had made that adjustment easier. The Big Fed not only earned Boland's respect and admiration, he earned something far more rare. Brognola was one of the few people Boland unreservedly trusted. Were it not for Brognola, Bolin might not have stuck it out as long as he had. Brognola had always been there when Bolin needed him, not just on the many ops they waged together, but where it mattered more, on a personal level. Bolin knew he could go to Brognola with anything, and the Fed would move heaven and earth to help him. Even now, after he struck out on his own and had an arm's-length relationship with the government. So here Bolin was, deep in a quarantined research facility, risking his life to save that of one of the few people he called friend. A noise drew the executioner toward an open door. He was a few yards from it when a shadow filled the doorway. Pressing his back to the wall, he switched off his flashlight. A solitary emergency light at the far end of the corridor cast enough feeble glow for him to distinguish the shuffling shape that emerged and turned toward him. He let it take a couple of steps, then switched on his flashlight again. The bright beam caught the infected man full in the face, and it averted its eyes. Snarling, it groped forward. He was down to three rounds. A noise behind him alerted him that the stairwell door was opening. He turned his flashlight on it, and the door swung shut. But the crazies wouldn't hold off forever. If he didn't find Brognola soon, there would be hell to pay. The next room Bolin checked was Lab 24. The place looked like a tornado had ripped through it. Cabinets had been knocked over, their contents strewed wildly about. Every beaker and container had been thrown down, and broken glass layered the floor like a carpet. Bolin came to a shattered partition. Beyond it was a spacious chamber. Mutilated bodies were scattered amid busted chairs. Bolin was about to turn when he noticed that several of the fallen men wore uniforms. He remembered Barbara Price telling him that some of the VIPs were military brass. Stepping closer, he bent over a Marine. The insignia and name tag identified the deceased as a General Drake. In a far corner, something crunched. The executioner whipped around in a crouch. His beam revealed three ghastly shapes on their haunches beside another body. They reared up, their mouths rimmed red, and shuffled toward him, moving slower than he had ever seen the attackers move. Bolin started to back away, thinking they wouldn't attack as long as he held the light on them. But he was wrong. David McCarter didn't much like being separated from Bolin. They had worked well together. Left on their own, it lessened their chances of success, and he was not one to deliberately buck the odds. McCarter had always been a team player. True, he had an independent streak a mile wide and a temper he had to constantly keep under control. But he also had a knack for meshing with others. The SAS had recognized his talent. So had Hal Brognola. It was because of Brognola that he had become head of Phoenix Force. McCarter was happy to repay the favor any way he could, even if it meant putting his life on the line. Another positive trait was McCarter's devotion to his friends. He would do anything for a mate. In his estimation, loyalty was an earmark of maturity. Any man who wouldn't stick by others in need was no man at all. Luther Harkin was an excellent example of what McCarter despised. He wouldn't stop pacing, wouldn't stop complaining. Carolyn was seated next to Chandler, her hand holding his. The NSA man was a lot worse off than before. Sweat beaded his brow, and he tossed and turned in a dazed delirium.
He's going to get us killed, I tell you. We should be on our way to the surface, not stuck here minding someone who can't stand on his own two feet.
Quit your griping.
I speak my piece. Always have, always will. You don't become a captain of industry by being timid.
No, you become one by stepping on others as if they were bugs, by not caring who you hurt in your rise to the top, by always, and I do mean always, putting yourself ahead of everyone else.
You make that sound like a crime, but it's men like me, my dear, men with ambition and drive, who have made this country of ours as great as it is.
There are a lot of decent industry leaders out there, too. Men who care about those who work for them. Men who wouldn't abandon a sinking ship before the women and children.
Sticks and stones.
That's enough out of you. I can't hear the loons for your blathering.
I'm worried about Mr. Chandler. He's so hot, it feels as if he's on fire. He must have a temperature of 110. Can't we find something for him to drink? Water, maybe? Or a can of soda?
There's a pop machine 3 doors down on the left, but don't expect me to go. Those things could be anywhere.
I'll do it.
Now, if anyone should go, it should be me. I can be there and back in 3 shakes of a lamb's tail. Don't worry, I'll keep one eye on this room. If those Frankensteins show themselves, they'll be sorry.
Go ahead, then. But please, watch yourself.
McCarter wouldn't do otherwise. Flicking the flashlight both ways, he passed the first room, then the second, knowing attackers might spring out from anywhere dark. He glanced back repeatedly. Luther Harkin was in the office doorway, smiling enigmatically. He gave a little wave. McCarter didn't return it. The third room was only a few feet away. Slowing, he saw that it was as black as tar inside. He speared his flashlight beam into it. He had to use his remaining ammo wisely. 16 more, and the magazine would be empty. The slug spun the madman, but didn't stop. The berserker, formerly known as Deaver, took 2 loping strides. McCarter heard the slap of footsteps and spun. He thought it was another crazy, but it was Luther Harkin, moving in full flight toward the stairwell.
Come back, you fool!
I told you I always look out for number one! You'd be wise to do the same!
Good riddance to bad rubbish.
If anyone deserved to be caught by the berserkers, it was Harkin. They would be doing the world a favor. McCarter ran to the office.
Are the two of you all right in here?
It took a few seconds for what he was seeing to register. When it did, he drew back against the jamb. Bryce Chandler was up on one knee, his thick fingers wrapped tight around Carolyn Edmonds' neck. The whites of his eyes had turned scarlet, and his lips were curled back from his teeth. Edmonds' lifeless gaze was fixed on the ceiling. The tip of her tongue protruded from her mouth, which was parted in a scream she had never uttered.
No!
The thing that had been Bryce Chandler cast Edmonds aside and lurched toward him.
I was only gone a minute.
The executioner was a qualified marksman with a handgun. He dropped only 2 of the charging horrors. Then the third was on him in a flurry of flailing limbs and fingers, hooked to rend and rip. A blow caught him across the shoulder, catapulting him into a row of chairs. His legs became ensnared, and he fell hard. The assailant didn't give him a moment's respite. Holland had 1 round left in the Glock. He pointed it at the bridge of the madman's nose, but as his finger tightened, a flying chair smashed against his arm. The pistol discharged its lethal lead into the ceiling, and a second later, the crazed man-brute had Boland by the front of his biosuit, lifting him as if he were weightless, and threw him at the wall. The man's strength was prodigious. Boland crashed onto the floor and felt as if his chest were on fire. He slid his hands under him to push to his feet and felt steely fingers clamp onto the back of his suit. Again, he was lifted into the air. Again, he was thrown with ridiculous ease. This time, Boland hit on his shoulder and slid into a broken chair. 1 of the smashed legs, tapered to a sharp tip, filled his vision. He scooped it up as the steely fingers once again gripped his biosuit. Bunching his shoulder muscles, he twisted and lanced the chair leg into the attacker's left eye. For all their ferocity, for all their chemically enhanced might, the crazies were as mortal as their intended victims. The chair leg sheared into the socket like a hot knife into wax. Letting go, the madman grabbed it and attempted to wrench it out, but it was too deeply embedded. He took a halting step, then withered in a heap. Boland was a shade sluggish in rising. He hurt all over. Every bone, every muscle ached. His biosuit had been torn in 6 spots. He reached up to touch it and saw a fine sheen of sweat that wasn't his. Undoing the zipper, he carefully peeled off the biosuit and left it. The empty Glock was of no use, but Boland retrieved it and stuck it in his shoulder holster anyway. He also reclaimed his flashlight, which thankfully still worked. Moving back into the lab, he searched for something to use to defend himself. In the gloom, near the front, was a closet he hadn't noticed before. The soldier's fingers were a hair's width from the knob when he heard what sounded like a hiss coming from the other side.
It's the only shot we've got.
Ha ha.
Boland started to back off, then realized it hadn't been a hiss after all. It was whispering. Boland yanked the door open. A hand grasping a syringe flashed at his neck, but he blocked it. Hal Brognola's astonishment turned him to stone. His mouth moved, but no words came out. Like a sleepwalker in a trance, the big Fed slowly emerged, lowering the syringe. From behind him stepped a smartly dressed young woman who took one look at Boland in combat black.
I'm happy to see you, too.
Who is it? Move so I can see. They sent a hitman to save us?
He's a friend of mine. I won't ask you what you're doing here. All I'll say is that you shouldn't be. Please tell me you received clearance from upstairs first.
How could we? Without you, we had to wing it.
I was afraid of that. Then please tell me you came alone.
I brought along a certain feisty Brit.
Really? I'm surprised the facility is still standing. I will never forget this, even if it costs my job.
I don't suppose either of you would care to fill me in on what this is all about?
Maybe later. Oh, before I forget, Ms. Lucy Reese, meet my friend, Stryker. Wait a minute. You didn't think to wear a hazard suit? And where are your weapons? You never go anywhere without an armory.
It's a long story.
Boland motioned for silence. Something was happening out in the corridor. Gliding past them, he peeked out. Berserkers were filing through the stairwell door. He counted six in all, moving with that peculiar, shambling gait of theirs.
We've got company.
Back into the closet. Well, what are you waiting for? We've been hiding in there a good long while, and they haven't found us yet.
Reese was facing toward the VIP lounge, and she stiffened. Boland knew what he would see before he turned. A madman was at the shattered partition. It lifted a leg but lowered it again and began trembling. The drool oozing from its mouth changed to greenish froth.
What the hell?
Remember what Dr. Bellamy told us about these things burning themselves out? Maybe that's what we're witnessing.
But the abomination was far from dead. It stopped trembling and lumbered forward, sweat dripping from it in a steady shower.
If that thing gets so much as one drop on us...
Stick close to me. Into the hallway.
The crazies flew toward him, but his flashlight brought them to a frustrated halt. Boland retreated with Brognola and Reese on either side. Six berserkers.
Where can we go? There's nowhere we can run to that they won't follow.
A room on the left was nearest. Boland gave it a swift scrutiny. It wasn't a lab, it wasn't an office, but a combination of both, with a desk on one side and a table covered with chemical apparatus on the other.
In here.
Boland slammed the door and worked the lock. Then, grabbing a chair from behind the desk, he wedged it fast, just as the first blow landed.
This is a mistake. They'll break that down before we know it.
Maybe, maybe not. Hal, give me a hand.
Boland ran to the table. Sweeping the apparatus onto the floor, they lifted the table and pressed the top flat against the door, then put their backs to it to hold it in place. More blows rained, and Boland felt the table start to give. He dug in his soles. Brognola's jaw was set in grim lines.
I still can't believe you did this. Barb and Bear should have talked you out of it.
Who do you think helped me work out the logistics?
The door jumped on its hinges, despite the extra support, and several times Boland was sure it would cave in. Lucy Reese, meanwhile, was rummaging through every drawer and cabinet in the place. She found several knives, a hammer, and a microscope heavy enough to use as a club, and brought them over. Boland chose the hammer. To use it, he would have to get in close, but it was better than nothing. A row of canisters on a shelf also looked promising. One was labeled sulfuric acid. Suddenly, the pounding ended. Half a minute went by, without a sound.
Shouldn't we take a look and see what they're up to?
It might be a ruse.
Where is that British friend of ours, by the way? We can use all the help we can get.
He's babysitting Bryce Chandler and a woman we located, Carolyn Edmonds. Chandler's hurt, and the two needed safekeeping while I went to find you. They'll hang tight until we get back to them.
Minutes dragged by without a peep out of the walking horrors. Boland began to think that maybe it wasn't a ruse. Maybe the berserkers had gone elsewhere. Straightening, he wedged the hammer under his belt and took hold of the table.
Both of you, stand back.
Why push our luck?
David and our friend are waiting on us.
Bolin, Brognola, and Rhys slid the table far enough from the door for him to unlock it. Every nerve tingling, the executioner turned the knob. He saw no one. Encouraged, he widened the gap enough to stick his head out. The instant he did, a clammy hand touched his neck.
Yes, sir! Keep the pocket mask with you at all times. Do not need any more casualties.
Let's get a sound level.
Set it up, folks. Be alert.
Activate a charcoal. I'm on again at 30.
Gloria Stinger was having the worst day of her life. It wasn't bad enough that Richard Pratt was lording over her like she was his personal servant. It wasn't bad enough Director Benjamin was upset with her for allowing the two doctors from the CDC to go below and would arrive at the Spider Mountain Research Facility within the hour to take personal command. And it wasn't bad enough the repair crews still didn't have the phone lines up or the power restored. She had a new problem. Someone had penetrated the site after tossing tear gas to create confusion and sow panic.
They shot out the lock?
Yes, ma'am. I thought I should bring it to your attention right away. Should I inform Mr. Pratt, or will you?
Leave that to me. Secure the door and double the guards around the main building, if you would be so kind.
Consider it done, ma'am.
Colonel Williams did an about-face and marched off to do her bidding. Stinger was at a total loss. Why anyone in their right mind would want to break into a quarantined facility was beyond her. The TV crews and print journalists were having a field day with it, speculating terrorists were to blame. Pratt had nipped their sensationalism in the bud by claiming the tear gas had been dispersed by mistake as part of a practice drill. For once, he had done something right. But when all was said and done, Stinger's main worry wasn't the break-in or the power situation or even the director's imminent arrival. The thing she was most concerned about was the welfare of the doctors from the CDC. They had been below much too long. If they had come to harm, the blame would fall squarely on her shoulders. She should never have let them sweet-talk her into giving permission. Stinger headed for Annex D. Enough was enough. She had to get the ball rolling, or the next thing to roll might be her head off her shoulders. She had too much time and energy invested in her career to sit idly by while it collapsed around her. The workmen were bustling about like bees in a hive. Stinger walked up to the electrician in the Virginia Tech cap.
I want power restored in 15 minutes or else.
15 minutes it is, lady.
You're not putting me on?
Nope. We're almost set to go. There's still a lot of burned wiring to replace, but we've rigged a bypass that will give you full power. Lights, elevators, the whole shebang. A dozen roses and a thank you card, and I'll consider us even.
I want to be here when you throw the switch.
You got it.
Stinger was halfway across the compound when she saw Richard Pratt jogging toward her like a runaway locomotive. Judging by his flushed face and the thunder crackling on his brow, she figured she was in for another lecture on her general incompetence.
I just received word from a buddy of mine at the home office. You're never going to guess who is on his way here even as we speak.
Sir.
Director Benjamin. He must be coming to check on us. I want everything up to snuff when he arrives. I need to make a good impression.
You know best, sir.
Barbara Price didn't realize Kurtzman had come up beside her until she removed her headset and stretched to relieve a kink in her back.
Bear, you're making a habit out of sneaking up on me.
And you're making a habit out of working yourself to death. I figured you could use a bite to eat since you didn't have supper. BLT on marbled rye. Pickle on the side.
Oh, keep mothering me like this and it will go to my head. I'm starved. Keeping tabs on an op like this takes a lot out of a person.
It'd take a lot less out of you if you wouldn't shoulder so much of the work yourself. That's what we have a communication crew for. What's the latest? Is Jack en route with the packages yet?
Still no sign of our guys. Jack was all set to climb out and nose around when there was some sort of commotion. He saw four guys in black land a chopper and make a beeline for the front gate. The next thing he knew, people were screaming and running for their lives.
From what?
Tear gas. Now the National Guard has doubled the number of perimeter guards. They're also conducting regular patrols of the surrounding area.
Which will make it twice as hard for Mac and David to get Hal out of there.
When it rains, it pours. A VDEM director by the name of Joshua Benjamin has been on the horn to the CDC. He knows Mac and David aren't legit, and he's on his way there to get to the bottom of it.
How long before this Benjamin arrives?
His connecting flight was delayed, so he won't show up for another 40 minutes yet.
That doesn't give our boys much time. Any chance in delaying Benjamin even more?
We can't intervene directly, or it might raise eyebrows.
Is Benjamin on a government jet or a civilian flight?
Civilian, due into Washington, D.C. on a flight out of Richmond. From there, he's taking a helicopter to Spider Mountain.
What if the airline was to receive an anonymous tip that terrorists are planning to blow it up when it lands? That might delay it a while, don't you think?
It would also delay everyone else on board. Need I mention that our mission is to safeguard civilians, not inconvenience them?
Oh, what's a little inconvenience if it saves lives? Think of all the sacrifices Stryker has made. Don't you think we owe it to him to pull out all the stops on this one?
You've sold me. You're positively wicked when you want to be.
Now you know why women find me irresistible.